Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's November 28th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for tuning in to listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll have an update on the aftermath of the deadly attack on Club Q in Colorado Springs. And CityCast Denver host Bree Davies chats with Monica Martinez of the FACTS Partnership about efforts to convert old motels into affordable housing. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC News headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that, I'll host a live interview with political analyst and award-winning author Anand Girdaras about his latest book, The Persuaders. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Leland Rucker will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead this morning, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The judge overseeing a Marshall Fire lawsuit has denied a motion by Xcel Energy to dismiss claims the company says are unfounded. In late March, the owners of El Dorado Liquor sued Xcel Energy, arguing the utility's equipment, including power lines, caused or contributed to the December 30th firestorm that destroyed over 1,000 homes and businesses in East Boulder County. Boulder County authorities have not yet made an announcement on what caused the fire. Investigators have previously said they are looking into human activity, as well as the possibility of an underground fire at a former coal mine. Some of the first reports about the fire blamed sparks from a power line downed by strong winds. A spokesperson from Xcel Energy told the Denver Post the utility has not seen evidence that its equipment caused the fire and reiterated the position on Saturday. Judge Christopher Zenizek, a district court judge from Jefferson and Gilpin counties, is overseeing the lawsuit as a result of all Boulder County district court judges recusing themselves from the matter. Boulder County officials will host an open house tomorrow, Tuesday, November 29th, to obtain public input concerning the recently passed ballot measures that cover wildfire mitigation and emergency services. The event runs from 4 to 6 p.m. tomorrow night at the downtown Boulder County Courthouse. The public can provide input on categories ranging from wildfire preparation, strategic forest and grassland management practices, staffing and funding for wildland firefighting, and for search and rescue operations. The county is also asking residents to fill out an online survey by visiting the 2022 Boulder County Ballot Issues and Measures webpage. The survey ends on December 5th. Broomfield City Council is considering a gun ordinance this week. Juanita Hurtado has more.
Broomfield City Council will discuss implementing a new gun control ordinance on Tuesday. The meeting follows two previous executive sessions examining the implications of local gun ordinances that met strong opposition in September. The proposed rules include banning the possession and sale of rapid-fire trigger activators, requiring serial numbers for gun possession, raising the minimum age for purchasing firearms to 21, and proof of firearms training or shooting experience prior to a sale. Another ordinance will mandate firearm dealers to post signs and provide educational resources. The decision to take up gun control comes as Boulder, Superior, Louisville, and Boulder County face legal challenges from groups arguing that similar ordinances violate Second Amendment rights. For KGNU, I'm Juanita Hurtado.
A grand jury released indictments last week against two Clear Creek County Sheriff deputies accused of killing 22-year-old Boulder resident Christian Glass. Glass died from gunshot wounds after authorities responded to his 911 call seeking roadside assistance. According to court records, charges against the deputies include second-degree murder, official misconduct, and criminal negligent homicide. A spokesperson for the Clear Creek County Sheriff's Department said the agency terminated the officers following the indictments. On the evening of June 10th, Glass called 911 after his car became stuck on an embankment. Glass told dispatchers he had knives in the car and was afraid to step out of the car. Glass's mother said in a September news conference that her son was having a mental health episode and was petrified the night he was killed. Law enforcement personnel who responded to the call said Glass became uncooperative by refusing to leave the vehicle after more than an hour of negotiations. According to the Associated Press, body cam footage shows officers eventually breaking Glass's car window, shooting him with beanbag rounds and a stun gun after he grabbed a knife, and then as an officer approached the rear driver's window, Glass, in a panicked state, twisted in his seat and thrusted a knife toward an officer. Another officer then shot Glass 6 times. The Associated Press says they could not reach the deputies for comment, and court records show no legal representation for the officers. A group of activists protested outside the Immigrant Detention Center in Aurora last week, seeking justice for 39-year-old Melvin Ariel Calero Mendoza, a Nicaraguan asylum seeker who died in custody at the privately run facility in October. Authorities have not released information concerning Calero Mendoza's cause of death or the circumstances surrounding it. The Aurora Sentinel says an Adams County autopsy report is still pending. During last week's protest, activists read a statement by Calero Mendoza's family, who say they have not received information about his death from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, nor have been contacted by the Nicaraguan consulate to repatriate his body. The program director for the American Friends Service Committee told the Aurora Sentinel Calero Mendoza's death is indicative of the unsafe conditions and inadequate medical treatment at the center. Within the last decade, immigration and civil rights groups have alleged that GEO Group, Inc., which operates the Aurora Detention Center, has committed unfair labor practices by forcing detainees to work at the facility with little or no pay, and by also threatening detainees with solitary confinement if they refuse to work. The company is also facing a wrongful death lawsuit concerning the 2017 death of an Iranian immigrant who died at the Aurora facility. For today's weather forecast, the National Weather Service says skies will be mostly sunny with highs in the upper 40s, low 50s. Tonight, there is a 30% chance of rain after 5 p.m., with snow likely after 11 p.m. The National Weather Service says 1 to 3 inches of snow is possible for Boulder and Fort Collins, and around an inch for Denver. Also for Denver, winds could gust as high as 16 miles per hour during the overnight hours. Tonight's lows will be in the upper teens, low 20s. Tomorrow, the Weather Service predicts snow with a high near 24. 1 to 4 inches of new snow is possible tomorrow. There is a winter weather advisory in effect from 2 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesday. The current temperature in Boulder is 45 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. It's now been a little over a week since a gunman killed 5 people and wounded 17 others in an LGBTQ club in Colorado Springs. Governor Jared Polis went on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday and said he supports a reevaluation of Colorado's red flag laws, including why the suspect was able to own the firearms used in the attack despite an arrest record for violent threats. And the shooter made an initial court appearance on the Wednesday just before Thanksgiving. Joining me live from Colorado Springs is Heidi Beadle, journalist at the Colorado Times-Recorder. Thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
A major holiday just passed in the midst of a period of mourning for what is the latest in a history of mass shootings in Colorado. You've been watching the events closely in Colorado Springs. Can you start by catching us up on the latest details and how the local community has reacted in the aftermath?
Sure. The community here is in shock, but we're, you know, coming together. Over the, I think, last Tuesday, Colorado Springs City Council, they displayed the sacred cloth pride flag on City Hall. We've had, this weekend, we had survivors of previous mass shootings, including the Orlando Pulse shooting, come speak to survivors of the Club Q shooting. So people are, you know, they're in shock and they're devastated, but the community is rallying together and trying to make sense of what happened and start the long recovery process.
Now, the suspect did appear in court on Wednesday, and one detail that we had our own On Deadline newsroom conversation about Wednesday morning is that court documents indicate the suspect identifies as non-binary, and with them they pronouns. Does that, in your opinion, merit skepticism?
Yes. So just some context here, right? So in terms of trans people and kind of the rhetoric that we've seen from the conservative right, you know, the widely accepted kind of idea, right, is that gender is on a spectrum and, you know, people can identify with a gender identity outside of their gender assigned at birth. And it's not strictly kind of male or female. And, you know, the backlash from conservatives and people on the far right has been to kind of mock that idea, particularly with, you know, the idea of like, I identify as an attack helicopter and jokes along that line. You know, the shooter has a long history of being involved in kind of these like sketchy online spaces. He has an entry in Encyclopedia Dramatica, which is like a Kiwi Farm style website. And the culture of
Say what Kiwi Farms is for people who may be unfamiliar.
Sorry, Kiwi Farms was the online bullying website that drew a lot of attention for being tied to, you know, harassment campaigns that led to the suicide of trans people. And there was a concerted like online effort to get it. A lot of this stuff is very niche, like kind of internet culture things and involving websites like 4chan, which is kind of a cesspool of, you know, white supremacist activity and, you know, incel culture and just real extremist stuff. And all indications kind of show that Aldrich was, you know, involved in that kind of culture. Additionally, you know, statements from his parents, from people who know him, show a history of homophobic behavior. KDVR recently released a clip of Aldrich and his mother at Denver International Airport involved in kind of a racist confrontation after getting off of an airline. So the idea that, you know, this person is claiming a non-binary identity right after they killed five people at a nightclub is something for people to be aware of and to take with just be aware of the context of the kind of conflict between the trans community, the broader LGBT community, and, you know, places like 4chan and the far right. You know, after the Uvalde shooting, they were instrumental in spreading a hoax that was picked up by Arizona Representative Paul Gosar, that the shooter had been a trans person. So there's been a concerted effort to try to blame these sorts of shootings on someone who is trans or from the.
Oh.
Yep.
Sorry. Sorry, we lost you there. But yeah, so there's a history of trying to pin some mass shootings on transgender people, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Do you think that it causes more harm than accuracy when media outlets use them, they pronouns for this murderer in particular?
I wouldn't go that far. I think it, you know, it's important to recognize professed identity and call people what they want to be called. But it's important to add additional context and be aware that, you know, this is kind of suspicious. It's kind of weird. And it's an extreme situation. And this is the kind of like irony posting and sort of like gotcha moment that these web communities like 4chan are known for. It's kind of like a logical like gotcha, right? Like, oh, the tolerant left isn't going to, you know, they're going to make an exception for this person because they don't like him or, you know, it's an attempt at trolling and potentially, you know, more further mockery of both, you know, the victims and the community at large.
Well, I have more questions, but we don't have enough time. I just want to throw it back to you. Is there anything else that listeners need to know in this immediate aftermath?
Sure. The surviving victims are still, you know, struggling. They have GoFundMes and Venmo accounts, and they would greatly appreciate support if people are of a mind. Tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, so just throwing that out. Please keep the survivors in your thoughts.
I've been speaking with Colorado Springs-based journalist Heidi Beadle of the Colorado Times Recorder. You can find her work online at coloradotimesrecorder.com. Heidi.com and on Twitter at Heidi Beedle. That's B-E-E-D-L-E. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. We'll be right back. The housing shortage in the Denver metro area is a well-known problem, but so many proposed fixes seem too expensive, too controversial, or just too out of reach. So what if we took some of the city's existing structures and turned them into places for people to live? That's what Monica Martinez and the FACTS Partnership decided to do when they bought two dilapidated old motels on East Colfax. These vestiges of a time when Route 40 was a tourism paradise have since become makeshift affordable housing. But Martinez hopes her organization can bring stability, upgrades, and eventually more housing to these properties. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies sat down with Monica Martinez to ask her to explain why, as executive director of an East Colfax-centered nonprofit, she chose to take on the housing crisis, one motel at a time.
So, Monica, I have to ask, why would a community nonprofit like the FACTS Partnership do something kind of crazy, like buy two dilapidated old motels on East Colfax?
Yeah, I ask myself that almost every day, actually, now that I own them. But I mean, I think it's twofold. I mean, one, we strongly feel that the affordable housing crisis in the city of Denver that I love is so acute that we needed to get in the game and try to solve the problem, but also realize that the motels themselves are a unique land use type on East Colfax. Our organization is based on East Colfax, and this was the gateway to the Rockies at one time. It's dotted with these motels from the 1940s and 50s. And so we knew that this land use type was unique to this corridor. And given our area of focus, we could see these as an acquisition potential. And we've been trying to buy motels now for a number of years.
So you've got these places that already can house people in the area where you work. Why not do something to make that a more permanent solution for housing? Because they're already being used as housing in some capacity, right?
Yeah, for sure. They're not tourists. It isn't folks on their way to the mountains. It's now the working poor, people who can't pay first and last month's rent, who can't pass a background check. And so it was actually in 2019 that the FACTS Partnership convened a land use advisory committee. It was a committee that we called of land use experts, and we presented this concept. Could you buy motels? Could you buy them with debt? You know, so you have to borrow the money, right?
Yeah.
Could you pay for that debt while operating them as housing and cover your expenses, cover your debt, and still, charge a reduced rate? And this committee said, yes, we studied it and saw that this business type of acquiring a motel, converting it to housing could work. It took us till 2022 to finally execute on our vision to acquire motels. But while we were starting to do that, other entities, other cities around the country, here in Denver, even the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, came to the same conclusion. And it is, to your point, Bree, they provide immediate housing. That new construction affordable housing is a great way to address the issue of affordable housing. But guess what? It takes a long time to build a new unit. And instead, what we did is we bought these and immediately had housing to provide to the community.
Well, and I love the point that you're making here, which is that Colfax has changed, right? It like you said, it was the gateway to the Rockies. This was like pre-interstates. This is how folks were getting to Denver and then going on to the mountains. So those hotels served tourists. But that has changed dramatically in the last 30, 40 years. And people are now utilizing these spaces as housing. So why not put a little bit of stability maybe behind that? And you brought up the money component. And I just wonder, I know from the Denver Business Journal article that this purchase cost you over $4 million as an organization. How did you get that money together?
So in the spring, we approached a motel owner that owned two contiguous motels. They're right next door to each other. So I went to my board and said, let's just get them under contract, and then let's see what we can do. And that risk ended up paying off. We did have to put $50,000 down as earnest money. And you have 90 days where you then try to put your capital stack together. And we were able to, with a national affordable housing nonprofit, So they were the senior lender. They came in, and then CHAFA, Colorado Housing and Finance Agency, they came in at a $2 million amount. And then the Latino Community Foundation has a brand new Communities of Color Loan Fund. But guess what? Why were they all interested in taking a risk on a small organization? Because the city and the state also expressed interest in this deal. And so it was one of these, like, if they're in, I'm in. And if they're in, well, me too. And so this past Monday, City Council approved a $983,000 grant towards this project. And so those public dollars are going to be used. One, some of it is being used to rehab these properties, but the majority of those public dollars are grants that are going towards the debt.
So you're doing a lot of strategizing. How many, like, how many partners can I get to the table to make this work? And once you do that, then the city and the state saw what you were doing and said, okay, we want to help because someone's already got the ball rolling, right? Mm-hmm. This just, like, I have to say, this sounds really complicated and complex. And I wonder, what made you want to take this on as somebody that works in this community every day?
I'm very committed to our mission. The FACTS Partnership's mission is to strengthen support the businesses and residents that live and work along East Colfax. But guess what? If you just do that, you're not really solving the systemic issues of displacement. And I've always felt you have to do both. You have to both work with who's there now, but then create the community you want to see. And we strongly believe deed-restricted affordable housing is a means for preventing displacement. And unless we get in the game and work towards realizing that vision of new units that are affordable, if we don't try to solve that problem, then we're just, you know, contributing to the systemic weaknesses. I don't think it's for everybody. It really took all partners and the Land Use Advisory Committee I mentioned, political context. We really had to leverage all of our assets to make this happen. Community development is a complex space. However, we need more players in the space because the needs are so great.
So right now, the motels that you purchased are functioning as housing, but eventually you're going to demolish those motels to build more units and serve more folks. But I read that you can't redevelop them until 2028. What is taking so long?
That is the million-dollar question. These are motels that have been there since the 1940s, and we are still dealing with the decisions we as policymakers made when we were a car-oriented society. And that means that there are vestiges of that. And one of those vestiges is a billboard. This site has had a billboard permit since 1956. So there's been a billboard there for decades. And it turns out after we got under contract, maybe 6 weeks before closing, we all realized that that billboard lease does not expire next year, like we thought in 2023, but rather in 2028. And it turns out billboard companies feel very strongly about doing their job of advertising. And I think it's effectively because they can't build a new billboard anywhere in the city.
Oh, because of current sort of zoning laws say you can't just build a billboard. Mm-mm. Next to a house.
No.
or housing or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. We tried to buy them out, and it turns out they don't want to take our money. And it really then precludes redevelopment till 2028, which is a sad fact. However, given that the billboard lease has been in place since 1956, I kind of am relieved it's just 6 years I have to wait.
I know. So, you know, we know Colfax. There are these old motels up and down it, east and west. What is stopping us from redeveloping more of these into housing?
Well, I think a lot of people have come to that strategy. There is actually a developer, Catty Corner, from us that has acquired two of these motels, the Branding Iron and the Awani. The FACTS actually tried to buy the Awani, and we got beaten out by this developer. She's converting them to market rate apartments. In some ways, for those who really like this architecture, it's sort of a win. We're not demolishing all of these sort of vintage motels, and they do have an architectural value and a historic value. The FACTS would love to buy additional motels on the corridor and convert into affordable housing. And I know other groups are looking at that. And one of the exciting things is the amount of money that now that is being put into affordable housing. I think you and your listeners probably know Proposition 123 was passed. That's going to provide new dollars, dedicated dollars to affordable housing. And then what's currently still helping is the ARPA, the federal...
the rescue plan? Yeah.
Yeah. Dollars. Those ARPA dollars are being used by both the city and the state for this motel project. And so I do think over the next year or two, you may see additional motels acquired for this purpose. I'd love to, and I do have that in my plans, but I first need to catch my breath and, you know, make sure I'm managing these appropriately.
Monica Martinez, thank you so much.
It was nice to talk to you, Bree.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Juanita Hurtado Huérfano, Alexis Kenyon, Heidi Beadle, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then a live interview with award-winning author Anand Girdadas. That's just after the news headlines from the BBC.